News, I'm Brian Clark. It's primary day in South Carolina, where polls show former President Trump leading the state's former Governor Nikki Haley by about 30 points. Last night in Columbia, the former president spoke to the Black Conservative Federation's gala and said,
"Black people are so much on my side now because they see what's happening to me happens to them. Does that make sense?"
Earlier in the day, he came out in opposition to the Alabama Supreme Court's decision that an embryo is a person. He said he supports IVF procedures and availability. This weekend marks 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. Western leaders are traveling to Kyiv for commemorations amid fears that Western support is faltering. A jury in New York ordered former National Rifle Association chief Wayne LaPierre to repay $4.4 million after finding he used that money to pay for his own lifestyle. And Pope Francis canceled his planned audiences today because of what the Vatican says is a light flu. This is ABC News. Authorities in Athens, Georgia, arrested 26-year-old Jose Ibarra in connection with the murder of a nursing student, Lakin Riley. University of Georgia Police Chief Jeff Clark said,
"This is heartbreaking. This is a heartbreaking time for the university."
He said the homicide on a jogging trail was a crime of opportunity. Brain fog's been reported by many long COVID patients, and some doctors have written off those symptoms. ABC's Dave Packer says a new study could change that.
Trouble with concentration and recall, the so-called brain fog experienced by long COVID patients, has baffled doctors. Now research out of Ireland published in the journal Nature Neuroscience may have identified an actual biological mechanism behind it. Over 24 patients who had developed fogginess after COVID were shown in brain scans to have more permeability or leakiness of the blood-brain barrier compared to other groups. The suggestion that inflammation impacting the blood-brain barrier may contribute to people experiencing brain fog. Dave Packer, ABC News.
I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Earl Ingram.
My special guest is the curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society, none other than Claiborne Benson.
I want people to know that Wisconsin has a beautiful, rich African-American history. Many people think the King celebration and all of those other kinds of things are more important. They occurred in Wisconsin as well, and we've impacted the entire nation.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it. Navigating without a compass, eyes waiting, started to wonder. Metamorphosis, the loss of who you thought you was.
When your kid can't find the language, help them find the lyrics. Listen to the Sound It Out album and get tips and tools to start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Farmers have been urged for years to adopt more climate-friendly and sustainable practices. New numbers suggest they're making progress. Mike Moan reports.
This month, the USDA released the new Census of Agriculture, data that only comes around every 5 years. Mike Lavender with the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition says there's numbers detailing how much farmland is being used for climate-friendly practices. He notes there were some bright spots, but also room for opportunity.
Some of the data that we're seeing within the census reinforces for us that in so many ways it is about access to programs within USDA or information, making sure that we can use all of those avenues to drive adoption in the way that we know there is demand for.
Conservation data examples include an increase in the use of no-till practices, while the number of farmers using rotational grazing is down. Between 2017 and 2022, Wisconsin farmers boosted key conservation work, including the planting of cover crops. And while the data is new, Lavender cautions it doesn't capture how farmers are responding to new incentives from the federal government.
This is certainly pre-Inflation Reduction Act investment data. So while this is, of course, accurate and really important to wrap our heads around, there's even newer data that we're getting from Inflation Reduction Act funding demand that it's important to take into account.
The IRA provided nearly $20 billion to bolster funding for popular conservation programs. The USDA reported that applications exceeded the extra funding that was set aside. Ag researchers have noted while there's demand for these incentives, farmers have often faced barriers to being approved, with only 1 in 4 applicants being successful. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, lots of sunshine, highs in the mid-30s and a bit breezy. Breezy tonight. Currently, it's 10.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates, weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM WISS.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Welcome, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. Thursday night, Wisconsin or Finland, we said wherever you're at. Johnny, the Civic Media app, we tell people every night, it doesn't matter where you are. If you have the Civic Media app, you can listen to us anywhere. Open it up. And in fact, tonight, open it up right now. If you're out there, open it up. Live text us, Johnny. We had lots of calls last night. Yep. Tonight, we're trying to get people live text the show. Ask us your questions that way. You know, especially those of you who are, you know, like going, I'm not sure my voice is going to sound right on the radio. Hey, not a problem with the Civic Media app. You just open it up and you live text the show. Johnny and Tim, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. And Johnny, two great guests tonight. And I met our first guest. It was probably 2015, I think it was, Chris. We'll do a little bit more, but I'm putting together the Busted Pencils podcast, you know, kind of in the origin stages of just the podcast. And I'm going through it and I find this research out there from this guy who says, you know, I'm coming out of the opt-out movement, right? I'm taking my kids out of standardized tests. And he comes forward and goes like, hey, look, there's no need to take standardized tests anymore. Just give me a few variables and I'll tell your school what the test scores are going to be before the kids even take it. And I was like, no way. That's incredible stuff. And son of a gun, it was true. But we've got now the co-author. We've got our two guests here tonight. Our first guest, he is the superintendent of Manville Public Schools, New Jersey, United States. He earned his doctorate in education leadership, management, and policy from Seton Hall University. And before working in Manville, Dr. Maroon began his career as an educator in 2005 by serving, Johnny, check this out, as a social studies teacher.
Hey.
His co-author is an EDD, an associate professor of education, leadership, management, and policy at Seton Hall University. He has worked as a PK-12 assistant superintendent, middle school principal, director of curriculum and instruction, elementary school assistant principal, but started his career elementary school teacher. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Dr. Jamil Maroon, Dr. Christopher Tankin. Wow, there you guys are. Chris, do you remember that interview 2015? You're like, hey, man, kids do not need to take tests. You, the master, the magic man, just could say, hey, I can predict those test scores. Chris, how you doing?
Great. It's great to be back. Thank you so much for having us tonight. It's always a pleasure to bust some pencils with Johnny and Tim.
Hey, nice. That's what's up. All right. Thanks.
Chris and then Jamil, because Jamil's the lead author on this new research. We're going to get there. But give a little bit of background, though, Chris, to this whole idea of test scores and predictability. And the concept, again, for a new listener who's like, wait a minute, did he say that before students take tests, there are factors that can be used to predict test scores before people take tests? Is that was your original research, right?
Yeah, that's the original research going back over a decade. We've done that many times now, as have other people. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And so here we are now, though, and I'm going to bring this forward. I love the title, Pernicious Predictability of State Mandated Tests of Academic Achievement in the United States. Pernicious Predictability. First question, though, Jamil, where did you meet this guy Chris at, man? How did this relationship? I see a little Seton Hall connection there, but Jamil, give us a little, you know, how do you two get put together? And as a school superintendent, what are you dare doing writing information that might question the validity of state tests?
So I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Tinkin at Seton Hall. I was one of his students, and like everyone else who's taken his courses, you know, he walks in and he tells you that, and your brain kind of explodes, because here you are and you're doing all this work and you're trying to make sense of why certain communities don't do as well as other communities. And you know, he's presenting this, and it, you know, not to blow too much smoke off of Dr. Tinkin, but he was the best professor we had. And I would say probably everybody in our cohort would agree that, you know, it was constantly challenging what we thought, you know, what we believed, and really making us think more critically about, you know, the work that we do.
Well, so on this study then, Jamil, just let you, since you're the lead author, give us a, you know, the listener a little breakdown in background information. You know, what's happening? Pernicious predictability. Where's the title come from?
You know, I'm gonna defer that to Dr. Tinkin. When we were chatting about, you know, what we wanted the title to be, I think, you know, one of the things that we wanted to point out is the importance of background knowledge when, you know, looking at key terms and keywords. And, you know, for everyone, you know, that's not a word you come across every day. Yet, you know, we're expecting people to know what it means without having that background knowledge. Chris, what would you say?
Yeah, no, I think, look, in terms of this study, right, we wanted to just to determine the predictiveness of various demographic variables that relate to student background knowledge on the percentage of students who pass a state mandated Algebra 1 test. You know, colleagues and I have done this in Ohio, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, and other people have done it in Michigan, Virginia, a lot of other states. But in a nutshell, we were looking at how factors outside of the school, specifically in this case, student background knowledge, how they influence student test scores. And this study was really an extension of work of, you know, what colleagues and I have been doing and others over the past 40 years on this topic. This is not new in terms of the basic ground we're covering. And I think that's important. There is a long line of existing research that we drew upon and continue to draw upon for our work. But essentially, you know, once again, Jamil and I found that these demographic indicators from the U.S. Census data, specifically related to family human capital and community social capital, can successfully predict the percentage of students who receive a passing score on these tests. And in this case, it was a high school Algebra 1 test. So, you know, I just used a couple terms, family capital and social community capital. For our study, I just want to kind of define those for everybody, if you're okay with that. Family capital is primarily, right? It's the financial capital of a family. And inside that term are the skills, the talents, the abilities, which ultimately influence finances. And then, so for us, we focus on the student's family as the closest level of human capital, directly influencing the development of student background knowledge. And then we also look at the community social capital. And that's social capital is like the glue that holds communities together. And that's the resources, the institutions in a community, you know, like public libraries, parks, civic organizations, your local businesses, chamber of commerce, the social services that are in a community to support students, and the youth clubs, sports, student peer groups, you know, et cetera. So I want you to be able to kind of go over the results. You know, when we put all that together, something pops out, right? And so, Jamil, tell us.
So what we were able to do is, you know, we took a sample of 159 high schools in New Jersey.
Just make sure, 159 high schools, not high schoolers. 159 high schools. Okay, cool. High schools.
And what we were able to predict were the scores in 75% of those schools in our sample.
Okay, so there it is. I'm going to put that out there, listener. You're out there. My neighbor is going, what do you mean? Kids always say, they got to take the test. You could predict 75%.
Yeah. So what we did was we took two you know, variables. We took family human capital, which was represented by the percentage of families in the town who make an income of less than $35,000, and community social capital, which was represented by the percentage of households in the town with an income of over $200,000. So based on those two variables, our model was able to successfully predict, you know, about 63% of the variance in the test scores. And in other words, you know, if we were to have a set of test scores and we were analyzing all the various factors that might influence the scores, like background knowledge, factors identified, these factors identified as contributing to 63% of the variance. And that was based on, you know, we were able to explain 63% of the difference or variation that we saw among the test scores. And this gives us an indication of how much variability there are in these test scores that can be attributed to factors that are outside of the school's control and outside of the considerations that we have. And, you know, the higher the percentage, the more influential those factors are in determining the outcome of the test.
So Tim and Johnny, overall, look, 63% is pretty high. You know, that basically means that out of school factors that can't be controlled by teachers, by administrators, are driving the test scores here.
Well, you say that, Crystal, too. And I just want to do like a little backtrack to just not a 101, but an exploit background knowledge for somebody who's listening out there. Maybe the way to understand that is, you know, I remember teaching reading. I was an elementary school teacher too, Chris, like that. You know, one of the things when you're going into a reading lesson, you help the kids, you know, before they read, develop some background knowledge so that when they get into reading that passage, when they come across words that might have to do with a bowling alley, if they're reading a story about bowling, you've developed some knowledge of what a bowling alley might look like so that they're able to read with a little bit more understanding. Now, there in that scenario, we're providing background knowledge first before they enter into the reading. What I think you're saying is that you're the background knowledge, though, you're able to really determine how strong bringing background knowledge is to predicting test scores. And then the other part of that is, and then figuring out, well, who are those students that bring background knowledge? And the reality is that it's not a whole lot to do with what's happening in school. That background knowledge is developed before school, out of school, social capital construct. Johnny Lupinacci, how did I do for break? Oh, man, 40s. Look at that.
We're going to break.
I lost a little check. Yeah, when we come back, Johnny Lupinacci, bring us out of here, man. Oh. All right. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, the Fox Valley's home of Mino and the Mayor.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about 5 times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain, can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor. Visit notimetowait.com.
sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
Mino and the Mayor.
Hey, if I could find my grandma's recipe for grappa, maybe we could do that.
A moonshine?
Grappa.
Oh, grappa's not moonshine?
We don't like that term.
The Italians don't like the Kentucky or what?
And that's what it said on the arrest papers.
That's right. You're one of the few guys I know that the grandma did time.
Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
And on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
I love the music. Busted Pencils, the best bumper music on any talk show out there, especially education talk show. Actually, the best education talk show out there anywhere. Fully led at Education Talk, educated educators talking education. If you're on the Civic Media app, give us a text, ask a question. We've got our Dr. Jamil Maroon, Dr. Chris Tankin talking about pernicious predictability and the reality of test scores, how we can actually look at these. And I did a little background knowledge primer, but Johnny, you were saying your awareness of this predictability phenomenon.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's game changer, especially as a teacher. It was pretty early in my teaching career, and I'd started taking some grad classes, as most of us teachers do. And I was learning a whole lot about all the different factors that contribute to. And I really had the question, why is it so hard for students in the schools I'm in and for us as teachers to be successful, right? And one of it was I was pretty blown away when I learned the measures of success have a setup so that we're ultimately going to be failing. And that blew my mind. So it was like the high stakes test measurement stuff. And I was like, wait, what are we talking about? Like, I'm here, I'm all in, I'm ready. I think we have great learners. I think I'm ready to do great teaching. And, you know, and here we are and we're failing. Okay, let me see these scores, let me better understand it. And then I had a professor who told me he could predict based on other research and thing. It wasn't magic he had, but the kind of research our guests here do. Right. He said, what if I told you I can tell you with some basic information of who your students are, how they're going to score on this test, this test, this test, and this test. And we were in Michigan and he named a handful of high stakes standardized tests that high school students were taking. And I'm like, come on, this is like a magic card trick. No way. No way. You know, I'm in my second year teaching. I'm like, this guy, these professors, they have some magic up their sleeves. Well, actually, what research showed, right, like similar to yours, there is some real strong predictabilities, in fact, strong influences that are even stronger than the ways that we're paying attention to what's happening in classrooms. So that kind of blew my mind. I was like, why are we taking these tests? What are they doing? Here I am being caught between, do I teach to the test? Of course not. I don't let the test dictate what I'm teaching. But yet these are this is how we're going to get funded as a school. These scores really do matter. Then I have a professor who's telling me, well, I can tell you what they're going to be before you even take them. And I'm like, what are we doing? I'm like, I'm caught between like a lose-lose or maybe a win-win. So for Chris and Jamil, can you help like our listeners who are other teachers like me, and they may know way more about tests than I did then, but like really, like what does this research tell us and how does it help us better navigate this contentious position that we're in?
Yeah, so Johnny, you're hitting the nail on the head here. Our results and those of others show that these standardized tests simply don't measure learning of any student very accurately, right? The test results are easily contaminated by factors outside of control of the school. And it, simply put, the tests are really blunt instruments, right? I mean, if we could use background knowledge to basically tell you how schools are going to score, I mean, that tells you that the test is really blunt. But why does background knowledge show up in the test scores? I think that's what makes this so pernicious, is that we're going to be able to do this with every standardized test forever because of the way that standardized tests operate. So the background knowledge shows up. It's part of something. I'm going to use like an academic term here. It's called construct irrelevant variance. Basically, Johnny, it's what you saw. These are the things that are unrelated to students that can affect the test results. So it might be inappropriate test content. You know, some test content that's actually on our test isn't in our state standards. There's off-level test content. That happens sometimes. Some of the tests include content that isn't part of the grade level. Other examples include unfamiliar words, phrases, or think about this, like these word problems. Like there are examples of situations embedded in these test questions that aren't part of the formal state curriculum. Kids learn about them in their daily life, some of these contexts, but they don't learn about them in school. And I know Jamil has a lot of these examples. In fact, Jamil, you were talking to me, we were talking earlier, you saw this happen today in the classroom, right?
Yeah, I walked into a fourth grade class and the students were doing, you know, the math problem on the digital tool that they were using. And the students were so caught up with the word strenuous that they couldn't answer the question and they couldn't pronounce strenuous. They were asking the teacher, what does strenuous mean? And that was a math question that they were handling. And I've seen it with my son. You know, my son is in fourth grade. Last year on the state assessment, the question was about Diwali. And you know, he didn't have the background knowledge to write a complete essay about Diwali. And you know, like there's tons of examples like this. You know,
I couldn't do that right now, Jamil.
Yeah. And you see it consistently and regularly with students. And you know, in math, for example, if you're using a math problem and you're using some information or some vocabulary like gondola or you know, a word that students don't have and they have to write a math equation about skiing and things like that, you know, the students are going to have trouble understanding the question and it's not related to math.
Yeah, right.
It's related to something else, you know, and the students are going to get hung up. They're not going to be able to move forward. And it happens a lot on math tests. You know, it happens more often than we like to think, especially in our national and our state tests, you know, that we're utilizing.
And I look, we've all been teachers, right? But for people who haven't been teachers, one key to the process of learning is the integration of new information with student existing background knowledge, right? And so if a student can't relate personally to something they're reading or something they're learning, they're less likely to be able to learn it. That creates these issues that we see on standardized tests. And there are so many examples of questions based on specific occupations that are, you know, clearly middle class or upper class occupations or things that are only found in certain parts of the country. There's examples of questions with references to cultural issues that are not universal to all students. You know, there's questions that you have to have very specific life experiences to relate to. So the test questions basically assume, here's the issue, that all students have a standardized upbringing and they don't.
Right.
So that gets to be
kind of hitting the nail on the head on top of another nail that we're putting in the board here, because it sounds like we're saying we have some evidence here that the tests are sort of culturally biased, right? They're and that's thinking that, and maybe even non-intentionally, right? It's not like there's this malicious effort to slant the test towards a particular group of students, but we understand what we normalize as sort of culture writ large gets worked into the test. And then I've been finding too of recent kind of the pendulum swinging, like awareness of cultural bias, it sort of swung to these obscure, like not connected, like it really showed our cultural incompetency. Because it was like, I was reading a math problem on a standardized test the other day and it was talking about someone buying 72 watermelons. And I remember thinking to myself, like, if I was a kid, I'd be so distracted, because I'm distracted right now because who's buying 72 watermelons? What are they doing with this many? Are they a restaurant owner? And all of a sudden now I've used too much time that I'm supposed to use on that to do well on the test. And so I made a little joke about it, but you know, I really appreciate this because it opens that question up. Because for so many of our folks out there listening that might not have that teaching background that we all have, or if you're a teacher listening and you were as dumbfounded as I was about these tests, you know, this helps demystify the process a little bit and then open up why we're talking about them, why it's important to question those scores and that system.
You gotta always, Johnny, gotta question the scores. Standardized tests, what do they measure? More.
From the home of the largest fly-in in the world, We are Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. It's primary day in South Carolina, where polls show former President Trump leading the state's former governor Nikki Haley by about 30 points. Last night in Columbia, the former president spoke to the Black Conservative Federation's gala and said,
"Black people are so much on my side now because they see what's happening to me happens to them. Does that make sense?"
Earlier in the day, he came out in opposition to the Alabama Supreme Court's decision that an embryo is a person. He said he supports IVF procedures and availability. This weekend marks 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. Western leaders are traveling to Kyiv for commemorations amid fears that Western support is faltering. A jury in New York ordered former National Rifle Association chief Wayne LaPierre to repay $4.4 million after finding he used that money to pay for his own lifestyle. And Pope Francis canceled his planned audiences today because of what the Vatican says is a light flu. This is ABC News.
A big win for the Bucks. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. After a rough start under new head coach Doc Rivers, the Bucks beat the Timberwolves in Minnesota, 112-107. Giannis with 33 points, Damian Lillard with 21, then went live after the game on ESPN.
A lot of scrutiny about Doc Rivers after the 3-7 start, but this is a very impressive win. From the inside, what has that transition been like?
On the inside, it's been good. I think we understand that. Having our third coach this season, including our interim coach, it's going to take some time, you know, to get adjusted and to kind of reestablish who we want to be and what we want to do on both sides of the ball. And when you're going through that type of transition midseason, you can run up against a team that's just flowing well. You can run up against a team that's just feeling good. A lot of things can happen, and, you know, we just haven't been on the winning side. But I think on the inside, we can feel the tide turning. Just got to do what we do and just keep pushing. That's it.
That's the Bucks' Damian Lillard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, lots of sunshine, highs in the mid-30s and a bit breezy. Breezy tonight, mostly cloudy and a lower.
Currently, it's 10.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You taught me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Matt Nair on air.
Hovde, Eric Hovde now. He will be running against Tammy Baldwin.
He's not a Wisconsinite. He threw his hat in the ring from California. This is Tim Michaels all over again. Businessman who walks in and goes, "Well, I can take care of this." And Wisconsin says, "No. Good to know you. Here's some Kringle. Go back home."
Is that how we politely blow people off now? Is take a Kringle and go away.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Matt Nair on air.
Want to thank our previous guest, Bob Bonadour from the Milwaukee Planetarium. He's so knowledgeable and obviously loves what he does.
Yeah, because he gets to talk about space all the time. I'm not kidding you. I have watched videos about space and have started to cry. It's so flippin' beautiful to me.
Well, we found your birds.
Yes.
We have found your birds.
Space is my bird.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Broadcasting from the Civic Media Studios on South Main Street.
This is Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking education. It is Wednesday. Educators Amplified are in the house. Teacher Joanna, Teacher Hallie, talking referendums in the state of Wisconsin. And the phone lines lit up. We're going to get to everybody here as we can. Glenda from Madison. What's happening, Glenda? You are on Busted Pencils.
Great. Thank you. Well, I really want to say a couple of things, but one is that I was a music teacher in public schools for many, many years and have found the problem with financing over and over and over again everywhere I've been. But the one goal I had was for children to become well-rounded at students, where we in music class, we would learn about music and cultures and turning them into readers and mathematicians. All of that came into my music class. And mm-hmm. I think that happens with all specials. It needs to be well-rounded, not just left brain, but right brain as well. Mm-hmm. That's a huge factor. The other thing I wanted to bring up, this is from the beginning of your show, your talk show, is the issue of right now, I think the surplus at the state level is somewhere between $3 and $4 billion. And the legislature is talking time and time again about sending that money back to the taxpayers. But in the meantime, we have districts, school districts, not just Milwaukee, but other districts asking the taxpayers for more money to survive. So I think that's a really funny hypocrisy, and I've been trying to figure that one out for a while now.
Well, Glenn, we are always trying to figure that one out for a lot of times out there. Thank you, Glenda. Thanks for the call. Yeah. Appreciate it. Appreciate your support.
Enough for your years of teaching.
And you are not a special teacher, Glenda. You are an essential teacher teaching essential. Music. Yep. An essential. Kathy from Cambridge. What's happening, Kathy?
Yeah, so I'm a first-time caller, and I'm saying the same thing last caller did, that they are sitting on $4 billion, and they will not release any to our public schools. I mean, that's ridiculous. And even when they were supposed to release, like, $130 million to the bipartisan pass for the UW here in Wisconsin, they helped, and they decided to wait until some diversity inclusion thing was taken out. I mean, what's this Ann Button or when it's already passed? This Republican-led legislation in Wisconsin's got to go. We need to get to the voting booth and vote these guys out.
Vote.
Oh, love it. Yeah. Kathy's dropping some pain on the certain legislation. Hey, new maps, though, coming in Wisconsin. We'll get to that. That might actually allow some ability to go there. And again, going right to it, Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, what's happening?
Well, I'm kind of on board with the last two callers, and if all these people that had referendums on their ballots would call the Republican legislators and tell them, we are tired of having to fund our schools by out of our own pockets, when you have this $4 million surplus or $1 billion surplus, whatever it is, it's time to take that money and put it back into our education system. This is just absolutely absurd, and I know why the Republicans are doing this. They want the schools to fail so they can turn them over to public or private interests and turn them into, you know, private schools. They don't want public schools anymore. They don't want children to be educated. They want them all to be brainwashed.
Thank you for that truth bomb. It's painful. It hurts, but she is right. I mean, this is the reality here too, is going, why is this happening? It's not because we, quote, can't afford it or anything. This is intentionality to create, as Johnny was saying, the market forces to go in and create a private education system. It is not only a defunding of public education, it's an absolute devaluing of the foundation of democracy, which it is public education. It is defunding democracy when you don't fund your public schools. You are defunding democracy. Teacher Hallie, you got something there.
Oh, I just want to say thanks to all of our callers. That's exciting. I love hearing from the people. And just kind of a response back to I encourage our listeners, whether you called in or not, and whether you're well-versed or kind of like
oh my gosh, I didn't realize this was going on, that Joanne and I had an episode on Educators Amplified, specifically amplifying the rally when we came out to the Capitol in Madison to explain like what's going on. And really specifically that podcast episode is hearing from more educators about the impacts of not getting the funding, which I guess we know now we didn't get the funding, but it's still good to go back and hear even more about, you know, the perspective of educators. So check it out. It's a May 2023 episode, Amplifying the Rally.
Amplifying the Rally, Educators Amplified. That's why they're here on Wednesdays, though. I mean, Teacher Joanna, Teacher Hallie, giving it, making it real. Teacher Joanna, your comments there.
Well, just hearing the callers, honestly, it was very personal to me to feel heard. So thanks, Wisconsin listeners and Civic Media listeners. This is something I wasn't expecting in terms of how good hearing the callers and feeling understood about what is happening. Because, again, as teachers, we don't get to hear that. We're not in positions. We can feel insulated in terms of being like, oh my God, does anybody even realize what's happening here? And so, yes, sounds like there's great advocacy groups out here. And the women throughout Wisconsin, as our callers, just demonstrated, are aware. And so when we know as a collective body that the money is there, but it's just not being put into our schools, right? Will we show up? Will we turn out? Will our kids, the schools and the education that they deserve?
Deserve. And as Johnny keeps pointing out to me, it's their right. It's not even deserve. It's their right. It's their child. Absolutely. It's their human. It's a human right that we put out there.
It actually is, right? We know about that. If we value human rights, and within that, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, so children's rights, like we acknowledge children as humans, right? Then all these things we're talking to aren't things we should be asking for. They are the role of government to provide. And I love that our callers and everyone here has reminded us that when it comes down to it, our civic duty as voters, wherever you identify in groups on that, is to understand the importance of these issues, right? They are how we fund and basically the investment we make on the quality of democracy in our communities when we fund our public schools. And so it is every way a matter of our voting, our need to vote, right, on these referendums to pass them, as well as, like our callers reminded us, our need to reach out to our legislators and make sure they know public schools matter to us as voters, to our, like the constituents are saying, we care about schools, we care about children and their rights to an education, right? And they represent that then at the legislative level. Ideally, we know that isn't always true. So we have to have rallies and meetings, which is really important, exercising our civic duty beyond voting.
Well, and I would say in every community where there is a referendum occurring, there is a group that is supporting it, you know, or has like a vote yes committee. And so please support those groups by either donating to them or signing up to engage in advocacy in some way, whether that is like, I'm just going to commit to talking to this many people, or I really am going to go knock doors, or I'm willing to drop off literature throughout the community. I'm willing to go to this event and host a table to talk about things. So if you are in a community that is having a referendum and you agree with our callers, please find that group and donate your time, because so much of those efforts in a way do actually sometimes fall on the public teachers themselves. And we're in a low to no gas situation out here. And so
Educators Amplified Busted Pencils Wednesdays, lots of gas. Well, I mean, 844-967-2789, 844-967-2. I mean, we've got full tanks is what I'm
less,
talking
less
about.
Hot air, here. Less hot air less than when it's just you have.
Energy. Right. I'm like, let's just talk about,
you know, put it there. But okay, so my
clean
neighbor,
energy,
though.
Clean energy.
My neighbor has a question, though. My neighbor is saying, you know, you can't see it on the live feed, but he's behind me right here going, but why do I have to pay more taxes if the money is already there and it needs to be fun? Why are you making me give up my money when the money is there and it's just not being appropriated the right way? My neighbor wants to know how you can help him figure out how he wrestles with this, because he's like, I don't want to pay any more money when I know that there is money. It's just not getting there. How do we how do we help him? Oh, I see stump faces.
Well, that sounds like Johnny would have a great answer to that.
Uh-oh. I see John. Oh, Teacher Hallie, jump in there.
I don't know. I got a hard time with your neighbor.
Hallie's going to scratch your neighbor, Tim.
Well, I'm going to have to bring Teacher Hallie's going to come talking to my neighbor. Okay.
No, I just some more like we can play this tit for tat game. You know, like it just seems like a low ball. I don't know. Like, no disrespect. I get people, you know, work and all that. But I am like, you know, I keep swirling around this concept, though, of like, these are essentials. These are not like, you know, like, what I mean by the tit for tat is like, I could be like, right, as an educator, and why do we have to beg for money? And why do we have this? And why do we that? And, you know, so it's more of this like coming together concept. It's more about the bigger picture than it is just about like an individual's pocketbook.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, he's trying to make the point, though. He's sitting over here. He's, you know, talking in my shoulder, just saying, he's like, I love my public schools. I love Friday night football. I'm there all the time. I get bratwurst with mustard every Friday night. I love being there. Thing is though, if I'm going to spend money on bratwurst on Friday night football, I need a little bit more money in my pocketbook. And if I have to give it in a referendum when the state is sitting on billions, that's Dr. Evil, billions of dollars. He's just trying to, and this, I think, Johnny, you feed in here, but then my neighbor needs to get civically active. Is that the Johnny Lupinacci advice?
I mean, kind of. I mean, I think it's fair to say this is a lot. Like, your neighbor has a question that a lot of people feel, and it's been framed this way for, I'll just say, for voters. The responsibility gets put on, you know, individuals, and this is a bigger problem culturally. It's across the country with school funding. Is there has been a massive, you know, push to individualize it, to localize it, and to say like, well, if you want to, you can ask people locally to vote a particular way and their money can go this way. We're not like, this ought to not be a decision made at individual local levels. It should be made at the state level, right? Public schools are part of a state funded initiative, and it should be dealt with in the budget that way. That's not to say that there isn't local voice in that form of representative democracy. But instead, what's happening in LA, Tom calls in and reminds us this. So this is what your neighbor, I would reframe your neighbor's question to really be like, I think we're on the same page. You're frustrated. We're frustrated. And who's responsible? And really, who is responsible is at the state level, budgets to schools were cut. Hmm. We're cutting back and really like we're trimming back necessities from, and then saying, if you want to make up the difference for what we've cut, you can run these initiatives on your local ballots, right? And then what happens is your neighbor understands that he's got to pay, or they've got to pay more money in their taxes, or they've got to pay more local property taxes, got to go up and different things. So really, it's the state level sticking it to the local, right? And so what I really want to say is, how do we all advocate? And some of our callers said that. How do we all advocate to come together to say, stop putting it on us? The cost of living is going up for everybody. The role of government is to provide these absolute essentials, and schools are part of it. So fund our schools from the state level. Take it from the big pot of money that you already do from all of our paychecks and make it happen. Stop putting it on us individually.
Oh, Johnny Lupinacci.
Hold on, Johnny, to respond.
There it is.
Well, here it is. You know, the systems that be want your neighbor and Hallie to fight, and I want them both to be pissed off and not to fight each other, but to fight the system that got us in that.
Right. Join me, neighbor.
Busted pencils when we get back. Yeah, Facebook Rico is going to be Caller Rico. Right, when we get back. Busted pencils.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support WISS, the Valley's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
The Todd Alba Show.
I'm Trigvi Olsen. Steven from Green Bay. Go ahead.
The city of Green Bay is one of the best places in Wisconsin to live. Plenty of people that are Wisconsin nice.
Totally agree. Green Bay is kind of swing territory between the two parties, but people in Green Bay work together. I mean, people aren't asking themselves, am I wearing a red hat or a blue hat? They're wearing green and gold hats.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Ah, yes. The heavy, heavy, heavy busted pencil. That is music to truly bust pencils by. Educators amplified are in the house on Wednesday. It is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, and truly, truly, truly educated educators talking education, referendums, taxes. My neighbor, he's so annoying, but Johnny helped him out. Oh. Johnny, he said, hey, he wants to get a beer with you. So well, there it is.
Hey, man, your neighbor is a voice of many. I know a lot of people, even close to education, who are really fed up with referendums and levies and bonds, and they're so important. They're so important, but they get framed in a way where it seems like it's going to cost us all more, and it really shouldn't. That's the real move here. It got put on the common, the everyday neighbor to shoulder this responsibility or to feel the guilt or pain from it, and really it ought to be at the state level.
And man, phones are just blowing up. Rico, Facebook, Rico, what's happening, Rico?
Hey, how you guys doing, huh?
All right.
Loving it. Hey, yeah, first time caller, long time listener. Hey,
nice.
You know, I'm going to stay on subject here, but I tend to veer a little bit here and there. And while staying on subject, I just come at it from a little teeny different perspective, but I want to see if there's some listeners out there that agree with me. Now, we've taken this whole thing that you guys talked about tonight with the referendums and everything like that, and we all have heard about that. But I want to tell you, does anybody else have a problem with putting the onus of this issue on our children? And what I mean by that is by sending them out into the public selling pizzas and cookies and, you know, hey, Papa can't buy 100 boxes of cookies from you, you know, so that you can win an Xbox of all things, you know. And you know, because like Kaylee brought up earlier, and I love that comment, 90% of them are going to public school. So once you sell these cookies to grandma, grandpa, and your aunts and your uncles and everybody else in your family, you're not going to sell them to the next door neighbor because his kid's selling them too. And I only have so big of a freezer. My freezer's only so big. That's what I had to tell him last time. I said, how many cookies you got to sell to get that Xbox? We did the math. I actually worked on math with him. And I said, you realize Papa would have to buy 100 boxes of cookies for $1,000. I'll just go to Walmart and buy you the damn Xbox. Okay, how's that sound?
Papa Rico dropping it. Loving it. Oh yeah, the fundraisers. I know, I get it all the time. Yeah. And you
but
know.
I love his point that it's putting it on the kids. Like they're out here having to hustle for the things in their schools.
Yeah, putting on the hustle. And hey, taller, another caller. Tom from Grafton. Tom, what's happening?
Hi. I agree with you that public education has been short shifted as far as the what they get from the state. And I'm wondering, has anyone ever done a study to see how much they'd have to give back or give to education to bring it up what it should have been, well, like say around, you know, 2005 or so before they, you know, got to be popular to really, you know, start cutting public education in Wisconsin. Would it be $500,000? I mean, $500 million or a couple billion or how much has public education been shafted?
It's a lot. I do not know that number right offhand. I'm looking at all of us here, and I think
WPEN does have that number. Yeah. I don't know it offhand.
That's Wisconsin Public Education Network. In fact, we had them on Monday night. Wisconsin Public Education Network. If you're listening out there and you have that number, but go, Teacher Joanna, you're pretty sure with that. Here's the other thing, though. People say how much money is due and should be due. I'm going to kind of play the other part and go. And the fact that in 2005 and 2006 and 2007, and how about the accumulated interest and the pain and suffering that was caused over those years of defunding? Let's put a little bit of that money on top of the price tag of saying this is what the kids, the teachers, the communities, this is what they're owed. This is their right to an education. Oh, I got confused looks on my faces there.
No, we were feeling with you, Tim. What are you talking about?
Again, liven it up for the heck of it.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I was going to try to see if I could Google the WPEN number. I couldn't find it that quick.
Well, no, I think it's a good thing for us to look into. I mean, it helps. We're throwing numbers out there, how much are being asked for and how much, like millions and billions here and this much on. We have the money here. You know, it'd be great. And I think the WPN, if they don't have it, they'll know exactly who does. Because our caller Tom brought up a good question. Like, someone's researched this because you have to know the numbers. I mean, I'm speaking in broad terms. It's a shortfalling that gets pitched as a gap and gets put on districts or local elections to fix with levies and bonds, right? And so that puts a certain constraint on school leadership. It puts people in a difficult position of what will children have and not have. And I also really like what Papa Rico called in and said, like when we think about this, like we're constantly in schools put in the position to be asking for money and sending kids out to get it in all kinds of ways. Fund this, fund that, fund this, fund that. Again, because we've cut back what funding.
And I have always dreamed of the day of like, what would it actually be like as an educator to be like, you're going to get this amount of money to use in your classroom. Like you're going to get like, I don't know how many meetings we've sat through where we have to figure out what can go, and I'm doing finger quotes right now, right? Like I've been a part of so many processes of what to cut back, and I used to sit there and almost like fantasize about like what the joy would be of having things added. Like what is that experience like to be like, what do you need?
How about this, Teacher Joanna, Teacher Hallie, what do you need?
What do we need? What do we want?
Well, I mean, just putting that, framing it that way, Hallie, right?
Sure. Sorry, I was trying to do math and listen at the same time. Sorry.
The point here is Teacher Joanna was saying, you know, we're always part of the process of cutting, even, you know, what don't we need? What don't we? And well, the thing is, we need everything, but we're actually making. To frame this and coming from the money coming to the day where you go, what do you need to allow the children to have the right, the essentials to a basic education?
Your home for Mino and the Mayor in the morning, weekdays from 6 till 8. Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about five times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor. Visit notimetowait.com.
Sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support. WISS 1100 AM Berlin. W252 DR Oshkosh. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. It is primary day in South Carolina, where former President Donald Trump is looking to